You're listening to Earth First Radio from the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
Deer cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, something, everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run, but there's nowhere to go when the job is done. How can we stand by while this all takes place? We've got to stop this inhuman race.
And welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Each week I bring you No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music for the activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. And we're going to have a little animal news here, and then we're going to follow that up with the first of a two-part series from our field reporter, Aeon Blues, for the Earth First Radio Network. And he's going to be reporting on the Minnehaha Road blockade back in Minnesota, so stay tuned for that. In the stories, you'll hear about folks who are killing the planet and folks who have detailed information about saving what's left. They all have names, addresses, phone numbers, fax numbers, email, or web addresses, so please go get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information I'm about to give you, because this isn't couch potato radio, it's activist radio, and I urge you to take down that information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, sending faxes, and making phone calls. When you aren't out in the woods, up in a tripod, or a tree sit, or locked down at the road blockade, of course, Earth First Radio can use your help. If you have announcements or news about what's going on in your bioregion, send it by email to cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com. Or send the letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Please send that information at least 3 weeks in advance. All right. Genetically modified crops may protect against pests, but it may not work. According to a research published in the Science Journal, a U.S. laboratory study concludes that one of the main pests responsible for damaging crops may rapidly develop a resistance to genetically modified products. And a federal appeals court has refused to stop Montana's slaughter of bison outside of Yellowstone National Park to prevent the animals from infecting cattle with a serious livestock disease. In a one-sentence ruling, the Ninth U.S. Court of Appeals upheld a federal judge's decision allowing the state and the National Park Service to continue killing bison as they have done for the last 3 years. And the Wildlife Service could begin killing problem wolves. Expensive relocation efforts and a shortage of places to move wolves could prompt the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to start killing ones that get into trouble. I'm predicting you're going to see us beginning to do lethal means of control, said Roy Herberger of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Boise, Idaho. I can't tell you when it's going to happen or where it's going to happen, but we're going to do it. And Keiko is preparing to return to the wild. Steve Clausen stands braced on the C-Pen walkway, documenting Keiko the killer whale's behavior as he frolics in the North Pacific with his favorite blue ball. But when Keiko swims up expectantly, hoping for some playtime or a treat, Clausen makes a point of turning away with a pained look on his face. It's time for tough love, for the star of the movie Free Willy returned with great fanfare 7 months ago to the Icelandic waters, where he was captured at a tender age of 2. And the greater prairie chicken is not as common as it once used to be in the Great Lakes region. It's disappearing from states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana. While some flocks have survived in Minnesota and Wisconsin, prairie chickens in Illinois are in trouble. Several management plans have failed, and now conservationists are actively working to save the few remaining birds. And members of the Macaw Indian tribe of Northwest Washington State took to the water a few days ago in the first excursion of their controversial gray whale hunt. Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Society, which has been monitoring the macaws' plan since they announced last fall they would hunt migrating whales. That's gray whales, says the Macaw Whaling Commission issued the permit at noon, May 10th. Watson says the macaw have hit a whale with a harpoon, the whale a cow with a calf, was observed to dive beneath the surface, and the whalers were unable to finish her off with their high-powered rifle. The Macaw Whaling Commission has drawn up a detailed whale management plan that specifically prohibits striking of female whales with calves. Watson's claim cannot be independently confirmed, but the Sea Shepherd founder says his group has been videotaping the macaw whale hunt from the air. And in other news, let's see here. I was reading in here. Where was it? Just after noon on May 10th, the U.S. Coast Guard boarded two vessels belonging to the Sea Defense Alliance and confiscated them. Court declared some months ago that protest vessels had to stay outside a 500-meter, that's a 1,600-foot buffer zone around the whalers. And Macaw Whaling Commission President Keith Johnson says the Sea Defense Alliance protesters were threatening the tribal whaling canoe and support boat. Local Santa Cruz Sea Defense Alliance person Jonathan Paul was one of the people taken into custody. And a report issued last week by the Predator Project, a Bozeman, Montana-based conservation group, highlights the successes of wolf restoration projects in the Northern Rockies, but warns against government downlisting of the species. The report, "At a Crossroads, the Wolf and Its Place in the Northern Rockies," examines the present progress of wolf projects, but also looks at obstacles in the way of successfully restoring wolf populations. And if you'd like to get a copy of that, you can contact David Gaillard, Predator Project, at 406-587-3389. That's 406-587-3389. Or email to Gaillard, G-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, at wildrockies.org. That's Gaillard, G-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, at wildrockies.org. And the Southwest Center for Biodiversity ran a full-page ad in the New York Times Monday, May 3rd, denouncing the livestock industry's century-long war on the wolf, blaming the industry for the slaughter of thousands of wolves, bears, mountain lions, jaguars, deer, antelope, and beaver. The ad reminded Bruce Babbitt, Secretary of the Interior, of his promise to make sure the interest of the public is protected against the livestock industry, which has come to think of public range rights as exclusive rights akin to ownership for running cattle for their exclusive use. The ad called on Babbitt to cancel public land grazing permits of ranchers who threaten to kill wolves and who aggressively pursue the killers of wolves which were shot, and to release wolves directly into the Gila wilderness. And in response to a 1998 lawsuit, the Southwest Center for Biologic Diversity and the Environmental Information Center, the National Marine Fisheries Service, designated critical habitat for coho salmon in central California and southern Oregon. But after bowing to political pressure, the National Marine Fisheries Service has delayed the listing for over a year until the suit was filed. Now let's move on to that special report from Earth First Radio Network, field reporter Aeon Blues. He's going to be talking to us from Minnesota, site of the Minnehaha Road blockade.
This is Aeon Blues reporting for the Earth First Radio Network. I'm here at the Minnehaha Free State in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where activists from Earth First and the American Indian Movement have maintained a constant vigil for over 8 months, protecting ancient trees and the burial ground of indigenous people from the Minnesota Department of Transportation's planned reroute of Highway 55. And here's their story. First, you'll be listening to an interview from Sky of the American Indian Movement.
I was out of my reservation, and I'm at Wapato in Dakota, and I heard about the native issues, the struggle that's going on here, how they're trying to, the Department of Transportation is trying to reroute Highway 55 over this sacred site. It's called Takuakan Tipi, which I'll translate to where the spirits are, where the spirits live. basically the grave site. And I heard the first thing I heard about it, I was a friend of mine's mom was talking to me, and she said, "Yeah, down at Minnehaha Parkway, there's some protesters down there, you know, and there's this one guy, he's in this 20-foot tripod with his neck bike locked in there. He's been in there for a whole week." She said, "Someone else is laying on a door, you know, with their hand through the small window in the door, you know, locked down to the earth or to underground pipes or whatever, so that, you know, stopping the bulldozers from coming down there." And she said that there was some AIM people down there supporting them. So, you know, I've been involved with AIM ever since I was a young kid. And
that's the American Indian Movement.
Yeah, AIM's the American Indian Movement, and our main mission and goal is native sovereignty, to make sure, you know, that the people's spirit isn't crushed by, you know, people who would be racist and all that, you know. So, yeah, I said, you know, I gotta check that out. I gotta go down there and see what's going on, see what I can do. And the first time I came down here, I was just planning on checking it out, and then I said, okay, I'll stay the weekend. And then it came to my friends had to leave, go back to work, and you know, I don't have to work because independently, you know, I got money or whatever. And so I decided, you know, I'll stay here the weekend, and then I decided I'll stay here a week, and then, you know, pretty soon it got around to I'll stay here for 3 months. And in all, I've been here about 5.5 months, because every time I get ready to leave, something else happens. We've been raided 3 times by the cops. They've destroyed sacred sweat lodge, our prayer circle lodge, that we have our sweat ceremonies in, sweat baths. They've destroyed a number of our teepees, which are our sacred lodges where we hold, you know, pipe ceremonies and, you know, any kind of ceremony. They've destroyed an eagle feather. They destroyed the drum where we sing our prayers with that drum, you know. And all these things are sacred to our people. And the one thing that really impressed me that's worked really well is that, you know, we've always been committed to nonviolence. And every time that they have come and been violent towards us, the news has been effective in that they, you know, show that we have not been retaliating in violence to them. You know, it could come to violence, but we're hoping that it doesn't, and we're hoping that this nonviolent way of using our spirituality is successful in stopping this campaign or stopping this road.
Right, now, you said with these sacred items and things, now, are they protected by federal law?
Yeah, the things, all sacred sites to the Dakota people and the sacred items are protected under the 1978 Native American Religious Freedom Act, which was signed into law by Bill Clinton. That's a federal law now. You know?
Good.
Yeah, the bill was signed, or the act was signed into a federal law by Bill Clinton in 94, I believe, 95. But it's the Religious Freedom Act of 1978, Native American Religious Freedom Act.
Right. And basically Minnesota isn't acknowledging it?
Well, yeah, there hasn't been, you know, any trouble until now with this, but, you know, they totally, Arne Carlson didn't publicly declare, but physically declared martial law that day here at Minnehaha Parkway. There were numerous, there was three constitutional rights that were, you know, stepped on: religious freedom, freedom of the press, and I forget what the other one is, freedom to protest or whatever, you know, nonviolent.
Freedom of assembly?
Yeah, freedom of assembly.
Right.
So, you know, that's martial law, that's in effect martial law, not to mention, you know, textbook definition of fascism is when big business and government get together and use military force to bring about their means and their ends, you know. So
right. Have there been cases filed in federal court?
We have a couple of lawyers that are working for us, pro bono or whatever, without cost. But right now, they're so overwhelmed with things that are going on, you know, at this time, that they're holding off. They're because we have a year to file that kind of stuff, but they just don't have the manpower to deal with that right now. So we're dealing with mediation, which was ordered by Judge Albrecht, that a federal mediator step in. We called the Department of Justice and asked for a mediator. They contacted the state of Minnesota and MnDOT, and both refused to go into mediations with the Department of Justice. They, you know, declined to mediate this issue. Then we contacted Judge Albrecht, who's a district court judge here in Minneapolis, and he ordered them into mediations with us through a federal mediator through the Department of Justice. So those are the things. Mediations are to begin just a couple of days, probably the 25th. Of was it February now, 1999.
Right. So they're stalled from building the road right now.
Yeah. Right now there's an order that they not proceed with building the highway, or construction of the reroute portion of rebuilding Highway 55. We're not opposed to them rebuilding and fixing up Highway 55 as it stands, but the reroute portion cuts through old growth oak savanna and the sacred site, namely the four trees, which are the markers of the Dakota burial site, which is almost all that's left of the burial site that hasn't been developed.
All right, so is the reroute pretty much a detour?
Yeah, it's just about a quarter mile loop that comes away from the existing roadway and then comes back to it where Highway 55 meets.
Right, so they would be wanting to pave over the sacred lands for something that wouldn't even be permanent.
No, because this will be Highway 55 if they are able to reroute it.
Right.
Yeah, they're moving it, you know, from the existing roadway.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say?
Well, you know,
you can talk, but
my relatives are buried here. You know, as far as the Native American issues, you know, there's been a lot of things stepped, you know, a lot of rights and just respect has been totally ignored by the state of Minnesota. And you know, my relatives are buried here, and you know, these are the people who were all genocided in the concentration, the death camps of Fort Snelling. Back in 1862, 1863, they allowed the people to come out of the camp to bury the dead, because it was a very confined place that they were all put in. They're basically put in a stockade. Teepees had to be put, you know, right up against each other in order for them all to fit in there, and they weren't given any firewood or any, you know, medicines. They were only given, you know, rotten food and things like that. Basically anything you would imagine of prisoner of war camps of, you know, say Vietnam, all the nightmares that have been told about, you know, things like that have happened to people. There's a lot of dead people here. They would die, you know, between 60 to 100 people a day in that camp. There's probably, you know, upwards of 1,000 people or more buried here at this site. And, you know, they just want to add insult to genocide and reroute over this burial place, which is basically for Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota, you know, Winnebago and Ojibwe peoples, our national cemetery. You know, it's like trying to reroute over Arlington National Cemetery is what they're trying to do to the Native American people who are here and suffered through these things back in the 1800s. And so All I really have to say, you know, is what I've said since the beginning. Just, you know, when I die, when I go, bury my heart where MnDOT won't find it.
And coming up next are three activists who were present during the December raid, where police brutally arrested nonviolent activists and used pepper spray and tear gas and beat them and dragged them. But stay tuned. You'll hear all the gory details.
On December 19th, at about 11:30 at night, I got a call that said the police were going to raid the camp and that they needed support people to come. I'm not a member of Earth First nor of the American Indian Movement, but I've been a camp supporter since Earth First started the camp in August, and I've stopped by and brought donations and tried to be supportive in whatever way I could. I got there at just after midnight, and it was very, very quiet. We began to wonder where they were staging this raid, having no idea of the scope of it. And so some of us walked around the site to look at the places where they'd staged things before, the Bureau of Mines building that has a fenced-in area back there and some of the other places. And it was just totally quiet at those places, like too quiet. At 3:30 in the morning, someone came by in a truck and said, I just counted 51 cop cars lined up behind the airport. The police had been having a pep rally in a hangar at the airport, and there were 600 police officers in an enormous parade of cop cars. So at 3:30 in the morning, I was given the job of running down to all the rest of the houses and making sure everybody was woke up to know that they were on their way. And I didn't know that I was also supposed to go, or that no one had been sent to wake people up in the tent, so that was kind of unfortunate. There were some people who were brutally awakened by the police. But at 3:30, I woke up everybody in the houses, and everybody scrambled to their lockdown sites. People gathered in Carol Kratz's house to kind of wait what was going to happen. And I watched Sam, Joe Hill, climbing up into his tripod. And I had come probably partly because I was concerned about what was going to happen when the police confronted Joe. He's in a life-threatening situation with a bicycle lock around his neck, 20 feet up in the air on a steel tripod. And so I, you know, tried to ask Joe if there was any way that I could help him, and he said that there was really no way that I could help him. And he was having a lot of difficulty because he's wearing all this winter garb. December 20th in Minnesota is kind of a cold time of the year. We're talking about below zero weather. And I asked Joe if he'd like me to climb up on the roof and be a support person who was at his level. And he said that would make him very happy. So I decided, at the spur of the moment, that my place to be a support person would be to be a witness for what was going to happen to Joe. And I sat on the peak of the roof, not far from where Joe was, and from there I had a much better view of what was coming down the street and stuff than the people who were on the ground. So I was kind of in dialogue with them with what I could see going on at the other houses, and it was all very, very quiet. And I sat on the roof until 4:35. And at 4:35, big yellow Ryder trucks, rental trucks, the kind like you would rent to move, started rolling around the corner. They were going pretty fast, I thought, and they didn't have headlights on, and I remember thinking, who would be moving at this hour? What's the deal? And they really fast backed up to each of the houses, one yellow truck to each house, followed by an endless line of state patrol cars that was phenomenal. The garage doors exploded up, or shot up as fast as you could imagine garage doors going up, and men exploded out of those trucks. And they were carrying assault rifles and batons and flashlights, and they smashed everyone to the ground. I had an incredible view of the violence they were doing. They were fast and efficient. They knew exactly where they were going. They knew where all the lockdowns were. They ran specifically and directly and immediately to the lockdowns. They had a very, they were very organized, like they were all going to different places and they knew what their role was going to be. I was up on the roof, so I wasn't smashed down. I was just allowed to sit there for at least a half an hour, maybe more, watching them smash windows and smash people. Then they rounded everybody up, and during this time they were taking pictures of me and of what was going on around us, and I could hear them, and they were saying, don't worry about them, referring to the two of us who were up in the air. A cherry picker is coming to get them. But once they had rounded everybody up on the grounds, there was one truck for each of the seven houses, but the two houses immediately south of us had no protesters in them. And so there was a huge mob of these, well, we call them police, but they weren't dressed in police uniforms. They were in black military uniforms with face masks and assault rifles. They weren't the kind of police you're used to seeing on the street. But there was a big mob of them down there, and some of them decided that they didn't want to wait for a cherry picker. And they started to tip over the tripod without taking the lock off Sam's neck. And officers amongst the crowd stopped those gung-ho officers from tipping over the tripod, which could well have killed Sam. Two police officers, I now know that one of them is a Minneapolis police officer named Sergeant Mosey, climbed up on the roof next to me and asked me if I was locked down. I said no. They asked me what I was doing, and I told them I was witnessing for Joe on the tripod. Joe and Sam. Joe Hill is his code name. Sam is his real name. And then they asked me if I was going to come down, and I said no. And they pulled my glasses and my hat to the back of my head and held a can of mace in front of my eyes, just a little tiny aerosol can. And then they sprayed, and of course I closed my eyes. And then they held my eyes open one at a time and sprayed mace directly into them. And then I was blind, and at that point I was sitting on the peak of the roof with a blanket around me. It was below zero, and there was at least an inch of snow covering the roof and me and the blanket. It didn't start to snow until after I was on the roof. I didn't raise a hand in my defense. I didn't raise a hand to keep them from spraying the mace in my eyes. I maintained total nonviolence. When I went blind, I went limp because I was on the peak of a roof, and I was quite frightened about what they might do to me. I was afraid that I would somehow fall off of that roof. They very gruffly pushed me to the edge of the roof where another police officer picked me up like I was a living human being and carefully carried me down the ladder. He seemed like a nice guy. And then I was handcuffed and brought to jail and all that stuff. I was blind for 3 hours. I had chemical burns on my eyes that persisted for a week. Not on the eyeball itself, but on the skin all around the eyes and around the nose and the mouth. And I couldn't smell or taste for 3 days. It was really quite ugly.
All right. We're going to rejoin that interview next week and hear more about what went down at the Minnehaha Free State in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But we've run out of time at this point, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to end it right there. We'll get back to it on the next show. This is Earth First Radio, and we're going to head on out into some music here. This is a healing song. I thought it would be appropriate to have a healing song after all that description of madness. Santa Cruz and is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. My name is Uncle Dennis. Tune in to the next Earth First Radio show for more no compromise news, views, poetry, and music.